The merest trace of cloud floated indolently above the city of Lhasa. I turned over, and fell into a dreamless sleep. In the very early hours of the morning I awakened with a start of fright. I had overslept and would be late for the early service. Jumping to my feet, I hastily shrugged into my robe and bolted for the door. Racing down the deserted corridor, I dashed out into the courtyard, straight into the arms of one of the men of Calm. "Where are you going?" he whispered fiercely as he held me in an iron grip. "To early morning service," I replied. "I must have overslept." He laughed and released me. "Oh," he said, "you are a visitor. There is no early service here. Go back and sleep again." "No early service?" I cried. "Why, everyone has early service." The monk policeman must have been in a good mood, for he answered me civilly, "We have old men here, and some who are infirm. For that reason we dispense with the early service. Go, and rest a while in peace." He patted me on the head, gently for him, like a thunderclap for me, and pushed me back into the corridor. Turning, he resumed his pacing of the courtyard, his ponderous footsteps going bonk, bonk, with the heavy stave going thunk, thunk, as the butt thudded into the ground at every other step. I raced back along the corridor and in minutes was sound asleep again. Later in the day I was presented to the abbot and two of the senior lamas. They questioned me intently, asking me questions about my home life, what I remembered of past lives, my relationship with my guide. The Lama Minya donned up. Finally the three rose totteringly to their feet and filed toward the door. "Come," said the last one, crooking a finger in my direction. Dumbfounded, walking as one in a daze, I followed meekly behind. They wended a slow way out of the door and shuffled lethargically along the corridor. I followed, almost tripping over my feet in an effort to go slowly enough. We crawled on, past open rooms where trappers and chelas alike looked up in curiosity at our slow passing. I felt my cheeks burn with embarrassment at being on the tail of this procession, at its head, the abbot shuffling along with the aid of two sticks. Next came two old lamas who were so decrepit and withered that they could scarce keep up with the abbot. And I, bringing up the rear, could hardly go slowly enough. At long last, or it seemed long last to me, we reached a small doorway set in a far wall. We stopped while the abbot fumbled with a key and mumbled beneath his breath. One of the lamas stepped forward to assist him, and eventually a door was pushed open with a squeal of protesting hinges. The abbot entered, followed by first one lama and then the other. No one said anything to me, so I went in as well. An old lama pushed the door shut behind me. Before me there was a fairly long table laden with old and dust-covered objects. Old robes, ancient prayer wheels, old bowls, and assorted strings of prayer beads. Scattered on the table were a few charm boxes and various other objects which I could not at first glance identify. "Come here, my boy," commanded the abbot. I moved reluctantly towards him and he grasped my left arm with his bony hand. I felt as if in the clutch of a skeleton. "Boy, which, if any, of these objects and articles were in your possession during a past life?" He led me the length of the table, then turned me about and said, "If you believe that any article was yours, pick it or them out and bring it or them to me." He sat down heavily and appeared to take no more interest in my activities. The two lamas sat with him, and no word was uttered. "Well," I thought to myself, "if the three old men want to play it this way, all right, I will play it their way. Psychometry is, of course, the simplest thing of all to do." I walked slowly along with my left hand extended palm down over the various articles. At certain objects I experienced a form of itch in the center of the palm, and a slight shiver, or tremor, thrilled along my arm. I picked out a prayer wheel, an old battered bowl, and a string of beads. Then I repeated my journey by the side of the long table. Only one more article caused my palm to itch and my arm to tingle, an old tattered robe in the last stages of decay. The saffron robe of a high official, the color almost bleached out by age, the material rotten and powdery to the touch. Gingerly I picked it up, half afraid that it would disintegrate between my cautious hands. Carefully I carried it to the old abbot, deposited it at his feet, and returned for the prayer wheel, the battered bowl, and the string of beads. Without a word the abbot and the two lamas examined the articles and compared certain signs, or secret markings, with those in an old black book which the abbot produced. For a time they sat facing each other, heads a nod on withered necks, ancient brains almost creaking with the effort to think. "Harumph! Harumph!" mumbled the abbot, wheezing like an overworked yak. "It is indeed he. A remarkable performance. Go to your guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, my boy, and tell him that we should be honored by his presence. You, my boy, need not return. Harumph! Harumph!" I turned and raced from the room, glad to be free from these living mummies whose desiccated remoteness was so far removed from the warm humanity of the Lama Minya Dondup. Scurrying round a corner I came to a full stop inches from my guide. He laughed at me and said, "Oh, don't look so startled, I received the message also." Giving me a friendly pat on the back he hastened on toward the room containing the abbot and the two old lamas. I wandered out into the courtyard and idly kicked a stone or two. "You, the fellow whose incarnation is being recognized?" asked a voice behind me. I turned to see Akila regarding me intently. "I don't know what they are doing," I replied. "All I know is that I have been dragged round the corridors so that I could pick out some of my old things. Anyone could do that." The boy laughed good-naturedly. "You check poor I men know your stuff," he said, "or you would not be in that lamasery. I heard it said that you were someone big in a past life. You must have been for the oracle himself to devote half a day to you." He shrugged his shoulders in mock horror and remarked, "You'd better look out. Before you know what is happening they will have recognized you and made you an abbot. Then you won't be able to play with the other men at Chakpori any longer." From a door at the far end of the courtyard appeared the form of my guide. Rapidly he strode toward us. The Kila with whom I had been talking bowed low in humble salutation. The Lama smiled upon him and spoke kindly, "As always. We must be on our way, Lobsang," said the Lama Minya Dondup to me. "Soon night will be upon us, and we do not want to ride through the darkness." Together we walked to the stables where a monk groom was waiting with our horses. Reluctantly I mounted and followed my guide onto the path through the willow trees. We jogged along in silence. I could never converse intelligently on horseback as the whole of my energies was devoted to staying on. To my astonishment we did not turn off at Chakpori, but wended our way onto the Potala. Slowly the horses climbed the road of steps. Beneath us the valley was already fading into the shadows of the night. Gladly I dismounted and hurried into the now familiar Potala in search of food. My guide was waiting for me when I went to my room after supper. "Come in with me, Lobsang," he called. I went in and at his bidding seated myself. "Well," he said, "I expect you are wondering what it is all about." "Oh, I expect to be recognized as an incarnation," I replied airily. "One of the men and I were discussing it at the State Oracle Lamasery when you called me away." "Well, that is very nice for you," said the Lama Minya Dondup. "Now we have to take some time and discuss things. You need not attend service tonight. Sit more comfortably and listen, and do not keep interrupting." "Most people come to this world in order to learn things," commenced my guide. "Others come in order that they may assist those in need, or to complete some special, highly important task." He looked sharply at me to make sure that I was following, then continued, "Many religions preach about a hell, the place of punishment, or expiation for one's sins. Hell is here, on this world. Our real life is on the other world. Here we come to learn, to pay for mistakes made in previous lives or, as I said, to attempt the accomplishment of some highly important task. You are here to do a task in connection with the human aura. Your tools will be an exceptionally sensitive psychic perception, a greatly intensified ability to see the human aura, and all the knowledge that we can give you concerning all the occult arts. The Inmost One has decreed that every possible means be used to increase your abilities and talents, direct teaching, actual experiences, hypnotism. We are going to use them all in order that we may get the most knowledge into you in the shortest time. Hell, it is all right, I exclaimed gloomily. The Lama laughed at my expression. But this hell is merely the stepping stone to a far better life, he replied. Here we are able to get rid of some of the baser faults. Here, in a few years of earth life, we shed faults which may have plagued us in the other world for countless spans of time. The whole life of this world is but the twinkling of an eye to that of the other world. Most people in the West, he went on, think that when one dies one sits on a cloud and plays a harp. Others think that when one leaves this world for the next one they exist in a mystical state of nothingness and like it. He laughed and continued, if we could only get them to realize that the life after death is more real than anything on earth. Everything on this world consists of vibrations, the whole world's vibrations, and everything within the world may be likened to an octave on a musical scale. When we pass to the other side of death, the octave is raised further up the scale. My guide stopped, seized my hand and rapped my knuckles on the floor. That, Lobsang, he said, is stone. The vibrations which we term stone. Again he took my hand and rubbed my fingers on my robe. That, he exclaimed, is the vibration which indicates wool. If we move everything up the scale of vibrations we still maintain the relative degrees of hardness and softness. So, in the life after death, the real life, we can possess things just as we do on this world. Do you follow that clearly? He asked. Obviously it was clear, I had known things like that for a very long time. The Lama broke into my thoughts. Yes, I am aware that all this is common knowledge here, but if we vocalize these unspoken thoughts we shall make it clearer in your mind. Later, he said, you will journey to the lands of the Western world. There you will meet many difficulties through Western religions. He smiled somewhat wryly and remarked, the Christians call us heathens. In their Bible it is written that Christ wandered in the wilderness. In our records it is revealed that Christ wandered throughout India, studying Indian religions, and then he came to Lhasa and studied at the Jokhang under our foremost priests of that time. Christ formulated a good religion. But the Christianity practiced today is not the religion that Christ produced. My guide looked at me somewhat severely and said, I know you are a little bored by this, thinking I am talking for the sake of words, but I have traveled throughout the Western world and I have a duty to warn you of what you will experience. I can do that best by telling you of their religions, for I know you have an eidetic memory. I had the grace to blush, I had been thinking too many words. Outside in the corridors monks were shush-shushing along toward the temple to the evening service. On the roof above trumpeters looked out across the valley and sounded the last notes of the dying day. Here, in front of me my guide the Lama Minyadon Up continued his talk. There are two basic religions in the West but innumerable subdivisions. The Jewish religion is old and tolerant. You will have no trouble, no difficulties caused by Jews. For centuries they have been persecuted, and they have great sympathy and understanding for others. The Christians are not so tolerant, except on Sundays. I am not going to say anything about individual beliefs, you will read of them, but I am going to say how religions started. In the early days of life upon earth, said the Lama, people were first in little groups, very small tribes. There were no laws, no code of behavior. Strength was the only law, a stronger and fiercer tribe made war upon those weaker. In course of time a stronger and wiser man arose. He realized that his tribe would be the strongest if it were organized. He founded a religion and a code of behavior. Be fruitful and multiply, he commanded, knowing that the more babies were born the stronger would his tribe grow. Honor thy father and thy mother, he ordered. Knowing that if he gave parents authority over their children he would have authority over the parents. Knowing too that if he could persuade children to feel indebted to their parents, discipline would be easier to enforce. Thou shalt not commit adultery, thundered the prophet of that time. His real command was that the tribe should not be adulterated with the blood of a member of another tribe, for in such cases there are divided loyalties. In course of time the priests found that there were some who did not always obey religious teachings. After much thought, much discussion, those priests worked out a scheme of reward and punishment. Heaven, paradise, Valhalla, term it what you will, for those who obeyed the priests. Hellfire and damnation with everlasting tortures for those who disobeyed. Then you are opposed to the organized religions of the West, sir? I asked.
No, most certainly not, replied my guide. There are many who feel lost unless they can feel or imagine an all-seeing Father peering down at them, with a recording angel ready to note any good deeds as well as bad. We are God to the microscopic creatures who inhabit our bodies, and the even smaller creatures that inhabit His molecules. As for prayer, Lobsang, do you often listen to the prayers of the creatures existing on your molecules?
But you said that prayer was effective, I responded with some astonishment.
Yes, Lobsang, prayer is very effective if we pray to our own over-self, to the real part of us in another world, the part which controls our puppet strings. Prayer is very effective if we obey the simple, natural rules which make it so. He smiled at me as he said, man is a mere speck in a troubled world. Man is only comfortable when feeling safe in some form of mother's embrace. For those in the West, untrained in the art of dying, the last thought, the last cry, is mother. A man who is unsure of himself while trying to give an appearance of confidence will suck a cigar or cigarette just as a baby will suck a dummy. Psychologists agree that the smoking habit is merely a reversion to the traits of early childhood where a baby drew nourishment and confidence from his mother. Religion is a comforter. Knowledge of the truth of life and death is of even greater comfort. We are like water when on earth, like steam when we pass over in death, and we condense again to water when we are reborn to this world once more.
Sir, I exclaimed, do you think that children should not honor their parents?
My guide looked at me in some surprise. Good gracious, Lobsang, of course children should pay respect to their parents, so long as the parents merit it. Overdominant parents should not be permitted to ruin their children, though, and an adult child certainly has first responsibility to his or her wife or husband. Parents should not be permitted to tyrannize and dictate to their adult offspring. To allow parents to act thus is to harm the parents as well as oneself. It makes a debt which the parents must pay in some other life. I thought of my parents. My stern and harsh father, a father who had never been a father to me. My mother, whose main thought was of the social life. Then I thought of the Lama Inyadon Up, who was more than a mother and father to me, the only person who had shown me kindness and love at all times. A monk messenger hastened in and bowed deeply. Honorable Lord Minya, he said respectfully, I am commanded to convey to you the respects and salutations of the Inmost One and to ask you to be good enough to go to him. May I lead you to him, sir? My guide rose to his feet and accompanied the messenger. I walked out and climbed to the roof of the Potala. Slightly higher, the medical lamasery of Chakpori loomed out of the night. By my side a prayer flag flapped weakly against its mast. Standing in a nearby window I saw an old monk busily twirling his prayer wheel, its clack-clack a loud sound in the silence of the night. The stars stretched overhead in endless procession, and I wondered, did we look like that to some other creature, somewhere? Chapter 4, the season was that of Lhotse, the Tibetan New Year. We chelas, and trappers also, had been busy for some time now, making butter images. Last year we had not bothered and had therefore occasioned some ill feeling. Other lamasaries had held to the belief, correctly, that we of Chakpori had neither time nor interest for such childish pursuits. This year, then, by order of the Inmost One himself, we had to make butter images and enter the contest. Our effort was a modest one compared to that of some lamasaries. On a wooden framework, some 20 feet high by 30 feet long, we were molding in colored butter various scenes from the sacred books. Our figures were fully three-dimensional, and we hoped that when seen by the light of the flickering butter lamps there would be an illusion of movement. The Inmost One himself, and all the senior lamas, viewed the exhibits every year, and much praise was accorded the builders of the winning effort. After the season of Lhotse, the butter was melted down and used in the butter lamps throughout the year. As I worked, I had some skill in modeling. I thought of all that I had learned during the past few months. Certain things about religion still puzzled me, and I resolved to ask my guide the Lama Minyadon up about them at the first opportunity, but now butter sculpture was the thing. I stooped and scraped up a fresh load of flesh-colored butter and carefully climbed up the scaffolding so that I could build up the ear to Buddha-like proportions. Off to my right, two young chelas were having a butter ball fight, scooping up hand loads of butter, molding the stuff roughly round, then throwing that messy missile at the enemy. They were having a great time. Unfortunately, a monk proctor appeared round a stone pillar to see what all the noise was about. Without a word he seized both boys, one in his right hand and the other in his left, and threw them both into a great vat of warm butter. I turned and got on with my work. Butter mixed with lamp black formed very suitable eyebrows. Already there was illusion of life in the figure. This is the world of illusion, after all, I thought. Down I climbed, and walked across the floor so that I could obtain a better impression of the work. The master of the arts smiled upon me. I was perhaps his favorite pupil, as I liked modeling and painting and really worked to learn from him. "We are doing well, Lobsang," he said pleasantly, "the gods look alive." He walked away in order that he could direct alterations to another part of the scene, and I thought, the gods look alive. Are there gods? Why are we taught about them if there are none? I must ask my guide. Thoughtfully I scraped the butter from my hands. Over in the corner the two chelas who had been thrown into the warm butter were trying to get themselves clean by rubbing their bodies with fine brown sand, looking very foolish indeed as they rubbed away. I chuckled and turned to go. A heavy-set chela walked beside me and remarked, "Even the gods must have laughed at that." "Even the gods, even the gods, even the gods," the refrain echoed through my mind in time with my footsteps. The gods, were there gods? I walked on down to the temple and settled myself, waiting for the familiar service to commence. "Hear the voices of our souls, all you who wander. This is the world of illusion. Life is but a dream. All that are born must die." The priest's voice droned on, reciting the well-known words, words which now struck at my curiosity. "The third stick of incense is lit to summon a wandering ghost that he may be guided. Not helped by the gods," I thought, "but guided by his fellow men, why not by the gods? Why did we pray to our over-self and not to a god?" The rest of the service had no attraction, no meaning for me. I was jolted out of my thoughts by an elbow digging violently into my ribs. "Lobsang. Lobsang. What is the matter with you? Are you dead? Get up, the service is over." I stumbled to my feet and followed the others out of the temple. "Sir," I said to my guide the Lama Minyadon up some hours later, "Sir, is there a god? Or gods?" He looked down at me and said, "Let us go and sit on the roof, Lobsang. We can hardly talk here in this crowded place." He turned and led the way along the corridor, out through the Lama's quarters, up the notched pole and so on to the roof. For a moment we stood looking at the well-loved scene, the towering mountain ranges, the bright water of the Kaichu, and the reed-girt Klingchu. Beneath us the Nobulinga, or Jewel Park, showed as a mass of living green. My guide waved his hand. "Do you think all this is chance, Lobsang? Of course there is a god." We moved to the highest part of the roof and sat down. "You are confused in your thinking, Lobsang," stated my guide. "There is a god, there are gods. While upon this earth we are in no position to appreciate the form and nature of God. We live in what may be termed a three-dimensional world. God lives in a world so far removed that the human brain, while on earth, cannot hold the necessary concept of God, and thus men tend to rationalize. God is assumed to be something human, superhuman if you prefer the term, but man, in his conceit, believes that he is made in the image of God. Man also believes that there is no life on other worlds. If man is made in the image of God and the peoples of other worlds are in a different image, what is to become of our concept that man only is made in God's image?" The Lama looked keenly at me to make sure that I was following his remarks. Most certainly I was. All this appeared self-evident. Every world, every country of every world, has its god, or guardian angel. We call the god in charge of the world the Manu. He is a highly evolved spirit, a human who through incarnation after incarnation has purged the dross, leaving only the pure behind. There is a band of great beings who at times of need come to this earth that they may set an example whereby ordinary mortals may be enabled to lift from the mire of worldly desires. I nodded my head. I knew about this, knew that Buddha, Moses, Christ and many others were of that order. I knew also of Maitreya, who, it is stated in the Buddhist scriptures, will come to the world 5,656 million years after the passing of Buddha, or Gautama as he should more accurately be named. All this, and more, was part of our standard religious teaching, as was the knowledge that any good person had an equal chance no matter what name his own religious belief carried. We never believed that only one religious sect went to heaven, and all others were tumbled down to hell for the amusement of sundry sanguinary fiends. But my guide was ready to continue. We have the Manu of the world, the great evolved being who controls the destiny of the world. There are minor manas who control the destiny of a country. In endless years, the world Manu will move on, and the next best, now well trained, will evolve, will take over the earth. Ah! I exclaimed in some triumph, then not all manas are good. The Manu of Russia is allowing Russians to act against our good. The Manu of China permits the Chinese to raid our borders and kill our people. The Lama smiled across at me. You forget, Lobsang, he replied, this world is hell. We come here to learn lessons. We come here to suffer that our spirit may evolve. Hardship teaches, pain teaches, kindness and consideration do not. There are wars in order that men may show courage on the battlefields and, like iron ore in the furnace, be tempered and strengthened by the fire of battle. The flesh body does not matter, Lobsang, that is only a temporary puppet. The soul, the spirit, the over-self, call it what you will, is all that need be considered. On earth, in our blindness, we think that the body alone matters. Fear that the body may suffer clouds our outlook and warps our judgment. We have to act for the good of our own over-selves, while still assisting others. Those who follow blindly the dictates of overbearing parents add a load to the parents as well as to themselves. Those who blindly follow the dictates of some stereotyped religious belief also cramp their evolution. Honorable Lama, I expostulated, may I add to comments? Yes, you may, replied my guide. You said that we learn more quickly if conditions are harsh. I would prefer a little more kindness. I could learn that way. He looked thoughtfully at me. Could you? He asked. Would you learn the sacred books even if you did not fear the teachers? Would you do your share in the kitchens if you did not fear punishment if you lazed? Would you? I hung my head. It was right. I worked in the kitchens when ordered to. I studied the sacred books because I feared the result of failure. And your next question? Asked the Lama. Well, sir, how does a stereotype religion injure one's evolution? I will give you two examples, replied my guide. The Chinese believed that it did not matter what they did in this life as they could pay for faults and sins when they came again. Thus they adopted a policy of mental slothfulness. Their religion became as an opiate and drugged them into spiritual laziness. They lived only for the next life, and so their arts and crafts fell into disuse. China thus became a third-rate power in which bandit warlords started a reign of terror and pillage. I had noticed that the Chinese in Lhasa seemed to be unnecessarily brutal and quite fatalistic. Death to them meant nothing more than passing to another room. I did not fear death in any way, but I wanted to get my task finished in one lifetime instead of slacking, and having to come to this world time after time. The process of being born, being a helpless baby, having to go to school, all that to me was trouble. I hoped that this life would be my last on earth. The Chinese had had wonderful inventions, wonderful works of art, a wonderful culture,